Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Ian Urbina has written a book called The Outlaw Ocean, and what's remarkable about it is that you basically lived among some of the outlaws. Just give people a thumbnail for the odyssey that you took to become as intimately familiar as you could with life at sea.
The focus was human rights, labor, and environmental abuses that occur out there. So we chronicled, you know, murder of stowaways, the problem of sea slavery, and we visited some ships that were in the Thai fleet, fishing ships, where there were 5 Thai officers and 40 Cambodian crew, and the entire crew was there in one form or another of bondage. So wow. Some had been shanghaied and kidnapped, and others had been debt bonded. You know, they had a debt to pay for having been given the job, and they had to stay on board until that debt was cleared.
Some of the stuff that you describe in your travels is just downright scary, especially this chase you were on where the Sea Shepherd, which is a ship run by environmental activists, was trying to chase down one of these illegal fishing boats, and the boat tried to ram, I think, one of the ships that was chasing it. I mean, this is a pretty dangerous predicament to be in.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a watery Wild West, if you will, out there, especially on the high seas, which belong to no government, sort of no one and everyone. Even when there are laws, there aren't police enforcing them. And the case you talk about, these conservationists chased this ship from Antarctica all the way up to the coast of Africa, and the Thunder, as it was running away, you know, tried to shake their tail by going through these really perilous iceberg fields and cutting right through the middle of a horrific Category 4 storm. And at one point, like you say, turning around and chasing their chasers and trying to ram them. And, you know, it just became really aggressive, to say the least.
Yeah, because there's a lot of how much money can you make fishing illegally like this?
The Thunder was ranked the sort of world's most wanted illegal vessel because in the course of a decade, it had stolen over $60 million worth of toothfish or Chilean sea bass. It's called on hotel menus. So there's a lot of money to be made.
The other issue, of course, is, well, there's a couple issues involving the ocean. Is it dying? And where's all the trash coming from? I guess I ask you the first one first. Is the ocean dying? I have fishermen friends who say that at least up in Alaska, the catches have never been better.
Yeah, there are certainly some places where that's true. Sometimes climate change is forcing fish into different zones where they weren't before, and other times just good management has worked. But globally, the ocean is dying, for sure. And most fisheries around the world, over 80% of them are at breaking point, if not already past it. And so dying in the sense of the creatures that are in it disappearing, for sure, and dying in the sense of the overall temperature rising and that having dire consequences down the food chain, for sure. And then dying in the third sense that you cited before in terms of, you know, what by 2050, they're predicting that there'll be more plastic by weight in the ocean than fish.
Which brings us to the trash. Where is the trash coming from? None of us are conscious of, even with these paper bags, I mean, none of us are going around throwing them into the ocean. So how do they get there?
A huge amount. I just saw a study a couple of days ago about one of the largest contributors of microplastics into the coastal waters of the U.S. on the West Coast are car tires.
Car tires?
Stuff, yeah, it's just the rub off of the rubber tires and plastic from tires.
Oh, just the road wash, you mean?
Exactly. Oh. Exactly. The runoff from roads going down the sewers going into rivers, rivers going to ocean and accumulating. So a lot of this stuff is microplastics from our clothes, like again, go through the washing machine into the sewer system. Sewage treatment plants can't pull the stuff out. The biggest problem isn't, you know, straws and plastic bags, although those things are real and you see them and they're everywhere and it's really concerning. But the microplastics, the small stuff you don't see, is really what's accumulating quickly and getting consumed by fish and then going up the food chain to us.
Really?
And that's what in huge quantities is ending up in the ocean.
So the straw and plastic bag bans miss the point. It's happening because of the laundry and our car tires, huh?
I wouldn't put them in competition with each other. I don't think it misses the point. I think like the plastic bags and the straws and the water bottles, there's so many of them and they don't break down and they do easily travel from landfill to river. I think those are real priorities, but I just think in terms of metric amounts, these other factors are important.
Ian Urbina writes for the New York Times. His new book is called The Outlaw Ocean, and it's a good thing you don't get seasick.
It is.
Ian Urbina. Ian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Choke points. You may have noticed all the trees missing along I-5 in Marysville. That's because the state's been restoring wetlands in the area, and Chris is here with an update.
Yeah, drivers will have noticed a huge difference this week along I-5 and Highway 529 in the Marysville area. Workers recently breached the dike on the north end of Steamboat Slough to allow water back into the area for the first time in decades.
Had trees there for, you know, the last 50 or 70 years. Now you go by there, you're going to see dry land sometimes, and sometimes you're going to see where the estuary is filled with water from the tides.
The Washington Department of Transportation's Tom Pierce says they decided to reclaim about 12.5 acres of wetlands there because they will be taking about 2.5 acres in 2 years when they rebuild the I-5/529 interchange.
By doing this project now, we're creating this wetland, and it'll be in use for a couple of years before we do affect the other wetlands.
Pierce says this will help establish a new habitat before they take a little bit away.
We've also done a bunch of planting in the area of just to match what's in the surrounding wetlands. In a few years, it'll look just like the other wetlands.
They left a bunch of trees and root balls that they cut down out of the area to provide a more natural feel to the wetlands. Also, those provide great safe places for juvenile fish to hang out.
When salmon come down the river, you know, they're very small and they're not very strong and everything. This wetland is going to give them a place to go in and kind of grow. It's like a nursery for them where they can get stronger before they head out to sea.
Now, as I've mentioned before, this is a precursor to the work on the new I-5/529 interchange in Marysville. Construction will start on that in 2021, and it's going to provide a much needed alternate to the single Marysville exit that we have today.
We're going to be adding a ramp from northbound 5 to northbound 529, and then also from southbound 529 to southbound 5. This is going to help alleviate some of the traffic issues we see at the main intersection in Marysville.
This is also happening at the same time that they're going to be adding that new HOV lane northbound from the Everett area that we talked about in a choke point last week. Be sure to check out the video of the dike breaching and the first tides at mynorthwest.com. It's really cool. It shows them in there, you know, all night long, digging through at a super low tide. And then as soon as the sun crops up, the tide comes in and the whole area fills up. I don't know why I'm so, you know, interested in looking at tides and stuff.
You should do at the beach. You'd build a big dam and the tide would come in and wash it away.
Yeah, and so it's kind of neat, and it kind of, you know, it shows the idea what they're trying to do is, you know, they realized however many years ago when they built things, you know, they didn't care about salmon or habitat or things like that. Now they're paying billions of dollars related to a culvert issue with
billions
the state.
Of dollars?
Well, no, I mean, I'm talking about the culvert repair that we're doing. We're playing catch up after that federal decree. So now where they can reclaim land as part of other projects, they do it. And this is a cool one, and it's a part of a project that will also help drivers. So
the salmon are getting some love now, but the drivers will get some love in 2 years.
Exactly. I see. And pretty soon the birds will be back. It'll be a panacea there. No, I'm just kidding.
You mean paradise?
Yeah, it could be. Yeah. Paradise. Yeah, I mean, if you haven't lived along I-5 in Marysville, I mean, it's kind of paradise right now.
Well, that's true. That's how I've always thought of Marysville. This is Seattle's Morning News. I saw a piece in the New York Times written by Karen Nussbaum, who is the founding director of Working America, which is an AFL-CIO affiliate. And the headline reads, Democratic candidates need to listen to these voters. She's talking about working Americans in the heartland, in Ohio, who have a simple message. Keep it simple. Don't tell me I'm wrong. Tell me something I don't know. And be honest. And so I want to ask you, Karen, did you hear any of that in this week's Democratic debate?
I think we heard bits and pieces of that. I think some of the candidates are paying attention. Most people are really hurting out there, and they're not paying much attention to what's left or right. They don't care about centrist or progressive. They really want to know that the candidates understand their lives and are prepared to fight for them.
You did a survey. You interviewed over 1,000 working class voters in the state of Ohio. And what was the prevailing sentiment in your research?
We talked to strong Trump supporters. We talked to people who told us they were definitely voting for a Democrat. But about a third of the people we talked to had not made up their minds about who they were going to vote for or even if they were going to vote at all. And across the board, jobs and income inequality were the number one issue. People really care about health care. That came across as the second issue. But after that, it began to peel off. Our undecided people were really concerned about Social Security. our Trump voters are still talking about immigration quite a bit, and the Democrats are worried about climate change. So you see that split, but still jobs are the number one issue for people. We hear so much about people telling us, I've got 3 jobs, I work 60 hours a week. The pressures on people are enormous.
What is it they want the government to do for them? Because one of the frustrations, at least to me, trying to cover these stories, is there is a sentiment that you can't trust government, but at the same time, you don't want to lose your Medicare. And, of course, the legendary comment from the 2016 campaign was, keep your government hands off my Medicare. I mean, you know, you don't want government, but sometimes that's the only thing that can solve the problem. So what is it that they want the government to do about, the, for example, having to hold down 3 jobs?
I'll tell you, Dave, people don't know what the solutions are. We go talk to people at their doors every night. We've talked to 750,000 people since the last election, most of them in working class communities around the country. And they're not the policy experts. And they often hold really contradictory ideas like the one that you just mentioned. But they want to know. People are so siloed in their sources of information that when we go to a door and we hear Fox TV on the other side of the screen, but we've got knowledgeable organizers there to tell people something they don't know, not tell them that they're wrong or that they, you know, why don't they know that Social Security is a government program?
Yeah.
But to help people walk through and connect the dots, that's what people are starving for.
Huh. So you go door to door and you discuss these issues with people?
Oh, you bet.
Okay, so when you meet somebody who says, the example you gave, I've got 3 jobs and I'm just barely holding it together, what kinds of ideas do you toss at them and how do they react?
Well, what we usually do is start any conversation, and we have these conversations all the time, every single evening, with what's the most important issue to you and your family. So we're really starting with what do people care about. We're not there to broadcast our issues, but to find out what's bothering them. And then we talk through, well, you know, how does that affect you and what does that mean? And then we'll point to, you know, why is it that you have jobs that pay so little that you can't afford to just have one stable job, or that one stable job doesn't even exist anymore? And we'll talk about the out-of-line influence that big corporations and banks have on our government and our economy, and that the solution is for us to band together, that we need to have good information, we need to join together, we need to find ways to have the strength in numbers. We give people a chance right then. They might sign a petition to expand Medicaid in their state, or they might call their senator to talk about the need for job protections.
Did you detect any enthusiasm for Medicare for All, which would at least take one problem off the table? It would take off the insecurity about a healthcare crisis, but then at the same time raises the prospect of higher taxes.
A majority of people support Medicare for All, and
really?
Nearly that many support a Green New Deal. And this is from our undecided voters. You know, they're not paying attention to the endless discussion and the debates about how will Medicare for All be paid and what are the different policies out there. They're just looking, they're starting from my problem. My problem is I can't get my kid covered under my policy, or by the time I pay my deductibles, it's like not having insurance. They start from my problem and they want solutions. And so when a majority of our undecided voters said Medicare for All, part of what they're telling us is we're not scared off by people saying these are extreme solutions. We want people to really talk to us about what can be done that's going to be significant.
So Elizabeth Warren needn't be afraid of saying, yes, we're going to raise taxes, but at the same time, we will make sure that you're covered.
According to the people we talked to, none of the candidates should be worried about taking what some people are criticizing as either left-wing or too progressive policies. That's not where these voters are. They're not paying attention to the labels.
Okay, and what about Donald Trump's solution for health care? I know people say he hasn't got one, but if you look on the website, the idea is to deregulate, use free market innovations like telemedicine, let people buy any kind of insurance plan they want, and let the free market essentially sorted out?
Well, a lot, when we talk to people, that's kind of what they've been living under, the free market, which just jacks up their prices every year. But also, it's not what Donald Trump is campaigning on. He's campaigning on scapegoating, on identifying people as the problem who aren't. He's ginning up hate. That has some appeal, but it's not where people go first. They would much rather have solutions that make sense to them than just continue to struggle with what they have and find someone convenient to blame. Don't worry about labels. Keep focused on the day-to-day problems that people are facing. Speak from the heart, and I think people will respond.
Karen Nussbaum is the founding director of Working America. Karen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.
There's an extra reason to cheer at the Seahawks game this Sunday. Heather Bosch has our charity of the month.
On first down, Wilson keeps, surveys, nowhere to go, and back in the end zone, touchdown! What a catch!
Crucial Catch is an NFL campaign that promotes cancer screenings. And for the Seattle Seahawks, the promotion helps fund a program called Crucial Cash.
And it helps cancer patients pay for some of the additional expenses they might have while going through cancer treatment.
At Virginia Mason and CHI Franciscan, spokeswoman Kim Baker says it's Crucial Cash for things like transportation to an appointment, childcare, or a hotel room.
Things that maybe people's insurance wouldn't normally help them cover.
During the month of October, the Seattle Seahawks are donating 12% of all the Crucial Catch themed hats sold through its pro shop to Crucial Cash.
And then also on the Crucial Catch game day, which is Sunday, October 20th, the Seahawks are donating 25 cents of every bottle of Dasani water that's sold at their concession stands.
She says the money adds up and truly makes a difference.
There's just so much weighing on our patients when they're going through this that anything that we can do to make it easier for them will make their experiences that much better.
Guy Radio's Heather Bosch.
Time for the Daily Dose of Kindness. You caught this story in the headlines this week, didn't you, Dave? The Monte Cristo wedding venue in Everett just suddenly shutting its doors.
Yes, I mean,
some couples paid $12,000 for the all-inclusive wedding.
Can you imagine?
I can, as somebody
having,
who has planned a wedding.
Having financed two weddings, I can't imagine.
Yeah, and for its part, Monte Cristo says that their main goal is to get the couples back their money. But meantime, we've got weddings coming up, like this weekend. And what's really nice is that since this news broke, other local businesses have stepped in to help, offering their venues, their services for free, simply because they can. Here's Cairo 7 TV's Dee Dee Sun.
You're in the historic Feather Ballroom.
When Lindy heard about the Monte Cristo suddenly shutting down,
my heart broke. I'm going to cry. It's terrible.
Cindy and Brian were supposed to have their wedding at the Monte Cristo this Sunday and paid about $12,000. I caught up with them yesterday.
Just frantically searching for venues and catering.
The Feather Ballroom says they had to help.
Not even a week before their wedding.
They're offering the venue for free to Brian and Cindy.
It was overwhelming. I mean, that we probably cried more from that than the reality of Monte Cristo closing down, because it was, when things go bad, they can go really bad for us.
Both deal with chronic medical problems.
I've been a cancer patient since I was 11, and I go in and out of remission fairly periodically, like every 2 to 3 years. Cindy, since she was 15, has had these a form of a cluster headaches, and these cluster headaches put you into like a seizure state.
So they have some insight on what it means for something to truly go wrong. But no, their wedding day will be just fine.
Much better than what we originally had dreamt of. It's just kind of hard to believe a little. And that's just off of the pure kindness and goodness of the community.
The value of what the Feathered Ballroom is offering is at least $5,000. That's just the cost of the venue rental.
It's time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And now, here he is, the man who just tweeted a picture of a book titled How to Hold a Grudge, which surprisingly was not written by him. Danny O'Neill, So the big Washington-Oregon game is going to take place in Husky Stadium this weekend. And since I have no idea what this rivalry is about, we've invited two special guests, Colleen, who went to the UW, and Chris, who's always rooted for Oregon.
And who has been under the foot of the Huskies through the 1970s and most of the 80s.
Okay, Chris also has some proud Duck lineage. I am concerned that Oregon's defense is, in fact, as good as it has appeared. I think they've allowed like 25 points total in their last five games. Like they've been stout, and they've beaten both of the teams that have beaten Washington, the hippies from Berkeley and the nerds from Stanford.
Yeah, but they're scared of us, Danny. So there's a factor there.
They're not scared of us.
Like, what?
12 straight victories over the Huskies. They beat any fear that they possessed out of us.
Well, you like are that, being fair.
Look, I think that the universe tends to right itself over time.
Mm-hmm.
And like, would they tell you a global warming trend happens in 12 years? No, that could be just fluky and it'll get back to basics. And they beat us 12 straight times and Washington still has the edge in the overall Washington-Oregon series. But I've learned enough to have a bit of hesitancy when it comes to making hard and fast proclamations other than there's nothing I want more this year than a Washington victory over Oregon.
The best thing about this whole thing this week from Danny has been the tweets about Oregon fans. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you and tell you that I think Enchanted Forest on I-5 near Salem counts as an amusement park. So, I mean, you're right. And what's funny, since I've moved up here and I now know kids who play for the Huskies who play on this team. So my hate for the Huskies has gone down tremendously as I've learned how to live and dance among you, almost like dancing with the wolves here, dancing with the Huskies. So, I mean, I still want Oregon to win, but you know what? I don't know.
I've
calmed
down.
I know.
You bring in some rivals, and everybody's like, "You've softened too, Danny. Where's your fire?"
No, I'm not.
You want the Huskies to beat the Ducks? The Ducks suck.
Our mountain is 14,000 feet high. Their hill is like 11,000. There's an idiot creek in Oregon. Like, there's all sorts of things. We're geographically. Where does the name Oregon come from? Does anyone know?
No
one knows. Best they can guess, it was a French-Canadian word meaning tempest. Only state in the Union, nobody knows where the name came from. They're like, what do you want to call it? And they're like, Oregon, I don't know. You know why it wasn't Washington? Because we already had Washington, and George Washington wrote a Tyrannosaurus in to take it over. That's our state.
Yeah.
Let's not forget it was the Oregon Territories before Washington decided to peel off its little corner.
Because we were good enough.
Hey, are Oregonians still unable to pump their own gas?
No, they're allowed to now.
They are.
That was my favorite part. I lived in Oregon I was born in Oregon. My favorite part of that is each year when there'd be a discussion about that, like, should we make it possible? You know, this isn't a real high barrier to entry. Like, it's not real tough to pump your own gas. They're like, what about the jobs? What about the jobs? We can't do anything else. There's only employment. There's the only thing that keeps our state economy afloat is requiring people to pump their gas for others.
Are you going to step in here, throw some bones? Come on.
You know, when you've won 13 out of 15, you just kind of, you know, you let it go.
That is a zit on the butt of the history of this series.
Oh, really?
So those 13 wins over the past 15. That would be like, it's a small sample size, Chris.
So what's the Rose Bowl count?
Yeah, Chris, how about that?
Well, I know Oregon's won the last one that they played in, and Washington made it to their first one and got smacked last year in playing in the first one in forever. So,
yeah, not forever. It was 2001 Rose Bowl was the last time they were there before.
Exactly, and what happened since 2001? 13 out of 15.
Yeah, that did happen. That is true, but it's slicing out, because if you take a broader perspective, the O on the side of Oregon's helmet still stands for the number of national championships.
That is true.
I didn't know that. I thought it stood for.
That's correct.
That is
in
true.
Case you forgot.
And it's tough when you have no Heisman Trophy winners and a half championship to hold over the Ducks, but you know, whatever.
Half championship? Wait, you forget about 1960?
That
we've got
doesn't
a mythical
count.
One, too.
Ooh, we're going
that
back.
Doesn't
that
count.
We completely invented.
It doesn't count.
Is this aggression making you uncomfortable, Dave?
Yes, it is. So let's get some predictions for what the score of the game will be. So, Colleen, you first.
Oh, Danny, you go first.
Danny goes last.
Okay.
Washington 35, Oregon 2.
That's okay. That's close. I was going to say Washington 28, Oregon 7. I'm going to give him 7.
All right, Chris?
Well, I would have basically that score in reverse.
I'm thinking in Oregon is a much better offensive team and defensive team. They're better in all three phases. However, Washington playing at home, Eason looks fabulous. And their defense, you never know what's going to happen. I think it's going to be 35-27 Oregon.
When is this game? Saturday?
Game is Saturday.
I'll be out of town. All right. Thanks, guys.
We'll tell you about it Monday.
Don't worry. If you come back and someone's squatting in your yard, it's just an Oregon fan. They're going to move along pretty quick.
Gotcha. The Sports Insider is brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thank you, Danny.
You bet.
It feels like just about everything in Washington, D.C. revolves around events on the other side of the planet. You have Ukraine. You have Syria. That's one of the reasons that we're happy to welcome former acting CIA Director Michael Morell to the program on Thursday mornings. He hosts Intelligence Matters, which you can hear Saturdays on Cairo Radio. So first of all, on Syria, I get the impression, I forget where I read this, that Turkey basically told the president, we're going to start this operation, either you get out of the way or your guys may get hurt. What's your understanding? Because this happened really suddenly, and I, a lot of people are confused by that, Mike.
Yeah, Dave, good morning. So that's one of the things we really don't know yet. We don't know what that conversation was like between the Turkish president and President Trump. That's the transcript that I would like to see. Because I can imagine a conversation where the president of Turkey says something like, Donald, I just want to cross the border and get my, you know, take care of a few Kurdish terrorists who have been attacking my people and killing them. You know, that's all I want to do. In order for me to do that, I need you to pull your troops back. And the president says, of course, that makes sense. I'll do that. So I can imagine that kind of conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I can also imagine a conversation where Erdogan says, we're going to go and your troops are in the way, and we're not going to stop for them. So you better get them out of the way. And President Trump blinks. So we really don't know what happened in that conversation. And that's something we need to find out. That's actually just as important to me as knowing about the conversation between President Trump and the Ukrainian president.
Speaking of which, it's turning out that Rudy Giuliani plays a key role in this. We just heard the testimony of the ambassador to the European Union, saying that he was told to that Giuliani was the guy to talk to about what President Trump meant about getting a corruption in the Ukraine. Is that routine for presidents to for a president to say, my personal attorney is going to handle this international issue?
So it's not routine. It's not routine for a president to go outside the process, but it's not unprecedented. It's not unprecedented for a president to use another part of the government than what would be typical, right? What would be typical in this case is to use the State Department. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be atypical or unprecedented for the president to use the Department of Defense or CIA to get something done. What is very unusual is using a private citizen, but even that is not unprecedented. I think what really matters here is less that the president went outside the process than what he asked of the Ukrainians. You know, he asked the Ukrainians to interfere in U.S. domestic politics. He asked for dirt on a political opponent. Mm-hmm. I think that is the main issue, and that is where our focus should be, not the fact that he went outside the process.
And this could be a situation similar to what we saw in the Mueller report. The president asks for something, but it's never carried out. So does that part make a difference? If he asks for it and it's never carried out, does that? Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. So that's I'm not a lawyer. So very important caveat. I'm not a lawyer. You know, I do know that if you conspire to rob a bank, that is a crime. Even though you didn't actually get around to robbing it. So I don't know about campaign finance laws. I don't know if conspiring to break a campaign finance law is actually breaking the law. So that's, I'll leave that to the lawyers, but it is certainly highly, highly, highly inappropriate for a president to use the power of his office to dig up dirt on a political opponent. And it is particularly inappropriate to do that with a foreign country.
I'm trying
and
to,
particularly,
go ahead.
And Dave, it's particularly it's particularly inappropriate to undermine U.S. national security by withholding security assistance from that country until they do what you want them to do, right? That's the icing on the cake right here, is that the president undermined our national security in doing so.
Right, okay, but well, that was my next question. Who determines what is in our national security interest? Ultimately, isn't it the president? If he decides that that is not in our national security, he can define what national security means, can't he?
So he had already done that. So the Obama administration refused to provide weapons to the Ukrainians to defend themselves against the Russians. The Trump administration comes in, and one of the first things they do is they change that policy, and they decide to provide weapons to the Ukrainians, in essence saying, we think this is in the national security interest of the United States. Mm-hmm. The president then, on his own, with a very, very small group of, not his national security advisors, but a very small group of his White House advisors, decides that he's going to withhold that aid until he gets what he wants in this political ask. Yeah. So he's actually undermining his own policy, right? He was the one to put this policy in place.
Right.
And he was going to restart that aid, but only once he got what he wanted politically.
Yeah, but that's like, me stealing my own money. I mean, he sets the policy, and then he decides to change the policy. He's not allowed to do that?
So he is allowed. He is allowed. Nobody is saying that withholding that aid was illegal. But people are saying, wow, look at the step he took. And it sends a really powerful signal, doesn't it, that American foreign policy is for sale.
Yes. Okay. Well, there's that. Your show this weekend is with a recently retired CIA spy, which sounds fascinating. He spent 30 years in overseas posts. And I've read a few books written by ex-spies on what this is like. But in the minute we have remaining, what do you look for when you're recruiting a spy?
Oh, wow. So that's a great question. So when we're looking to hire somebody who is going to go overseas and recruit other human beings to spy for the United States, we're looking for somebody with very strong interpersonal skills,
mm-hmm.
very strong emotional intelligence skills. And what is that? That means the ability to read somebody else, what they're thinking, what they're feeling without them telling you that. And then you're looking for self-confidence to the point of overconfidence. And that last one sounds a little weird, but it's important, because sitting across the table from another human being and asking them to commit espionage against their own country is one of the hardest conversations you'll ever have. And if you don't have a ton of self-confidence, you're not going to go anywhere near that conversation. So those are the three main things you look for. And then you look for an ability to learn foreign languages, comfort working overseas, those kinds of things.
I think you just described Rudy Giuliani, Mike.
I hope not.
Mike Morrell, you can hear his show, Intelligence Matters, Saturdays on Cairo Radio. Mike, thank you.
Good to be with you, Dave.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthwest.com.